This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Robert Cullen was in Lithuania on March 11th when the Republic declared its independence from the Soviet Union. Cullen was in Romania in January, just after the overthrow of the Ceausescu regime. Cullen is writing a book on the changing shape of the Soviet Empire. He's a former Moscow correspondent for Newsweek and more recently has been writing about the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe for The Atlantic and The New Yorker. We invited him to share his analysis of the revolution in Romania and the independence movement in Lithuania. This week, Mikhail Gorbachev warned that redrawing the boundaries of the Soviet Union would lead to civil war and bloody carnage. Lithuania was annexed by the Soviets 50 years ago and was turned into one of the 15 republics that make up the Soviet Union. I asked Cullen why Lithuania became the first republic to assert its independence.
I think the major reason is that Lithuania has a more homogeneous population than either of the other two Baltic republics. Somewhere between 80 and 85% of the population of Lithuania is Lithuanian, and that figure is only about 60 to 65% for Estonia and barely 50% for Latvia. So the Lithuanians had a stronger popular mandate for independence than either of the other two republics, and therefore they went first.
You were in Lithuania, I believe, when its independence was declared?
That's right.
I'm sure you spoke to a lot of people. You were there. Can you give us a sense of some of the reasons that people in the nationalist movement gave you for their fervor?
Well, there are reasons that go back 40 and 50 years. Some of the members of the Sąjūdis movement, which is the name of the independence movement in Lithuania, were children when the Soviets first moved into Lithuania in 1940. And they remember parents or relatives being deported. One man that I spoke to in a high position in Sąjūdis had both of his parents deported to Siberia, and he and his brothers and sisters had to more or less fend for themselves for several years before his parents were able to make their way back from Siberia to Lithuania. They saw their economy fall far behind the economies of the Scandinavian countries to which they like to compare themselves. They saw enormous losses in terms of freedom to say and do what they wanted. They suffered a great deal. One man who is the deputy chairman of the Presidium of the new Lithuanian Supreme Soviet had relatives who joined the guerrilla forces, which fought against the Soviets for about 6 or 7 years after World War II, and remembers bodies being thrown on the steps of the church in his village when the KGB forces would catch some of the guerrillas, and remembers how the people were afraid to claim the bodies of their relatives because they knew that people who showed themselves to be relatives of guerrillas would be likely to be deported to Siberia. So the bodies just sat there and festered. Those kinds of experiences don't leave people's consciousnesses very easily, and they breed a tremendous longing for independence. And that's the basic motivation, I think, for the Lithuanian Declaration of Independence, and that's why they're so fervent about it. As far as the immediate causes for their declaration, I think there are two or three things. One is that the Lithuanian leadership is not very politically experienced. Most of them are intellectuals. A lot of them are physicists. Vytautas Landsbergis is a musicologist. They haven't had any experience in politics, and as a result, I think they tend to look at their situation in a very legalistic way, as if this affair were going to be settled in the long run by the world court, so that they feel that they constitute the legitimate government of Lithuania, which had its sovereignty interrupted but not taken away in 1940, and therefore, as soon as they were able to convene the new legislature after the last elections, they felt within their power and their right to declare independence. I don't think they understand or appreciate the political situation that they're in and the need to try to work out some kind of politically acceptable deal with the Soviets that would give those in the Soviet government who would not want to block independence if they had to make the choice, some kind of face-saving way to give it to the Lithuanians. And so I think that they have also, I should mention that they were afraid at the time that when Mikhail Gorbachev was given his new title of president and new presidential powers, that he would use those powers immediately to stifle the results of the last election in Lithuania, to declare presidential rule or martial law, and to prevent them from convening as a group, so that they felt some urgency. They convened quickly, they declared their independence, or they restored their independence, as they would say, and they acted in a way that, while it may have been legally and technically correct, at least in their own minds, politically may not have been as astute as it should have been.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Robert Cullen, and he's been writing about Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union for The Atlantic and New Yorker magazines. He was a Moscow correspondent for Newsweek magazine and has a forthcoming novel based on his experiences there. When you were in Lithuania, you were not only exposed to strong nationalist feelings, but you met some people who had been in the nationalist movement and had grown skeptical of it. Would you explain their reasons for skepticism?
Well, there are quite a few Lithuanians who are disturbed by some of the, what they call, anti-democratic tendencies within Sąjūdis. For example, I had a long talk with Vytis Tomkus, who is the editor of a new newspaper in Lithuania called Respublika, which is a very freewheeling, slightly yellow even, daily newspaper that he began with backing from Sąjūdis. He now feels it normal and right to criticize some of the Sąjūdis leadership. His newspaper has been roundly criticized and condemned as a communist organ by the leadership of Sąjūdis as a result of his being critical of some of the Sąjūdis leaders. In other words, in his view, they don't really understand the principle of plurality of opinion. There are some other examples. I had some long conversations with a man named Arvydas Juozaitis, who's an extremely interesting person. He was the first Soviet male swimmer ever to win an Olympic medal. This was at the Montreal Olympics in 1976, and he agonized over whether he should wear a Lithuanian jacket on the victory stand in an effort to do what Tommy Smith and John Carlos did for the black movement at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. In the end, he decided he couldn't afford to do that because his parents might lose their jobs and he might lose his chance for an education. And he learned the lesson that an individual can't stand up to the Soviet government, but perhaps an organization can. And he was active 12 years later in the founding of Sąjūdis. But when I spoke to him during February, during the independence days, he had withdrawn to a large degree from Sąjūdis activities and had founded a weekly newspaper. And he felt that there was a conflict between nationalism and democracy, at least a potential conflict, and that Sąjūdis had made a mistake by choosing nationalism and nationalist goals as its first priority and democracy as maybe its second priority. Now, the leaders of Sąjūdis would say that there is no conflict, that they can be both democratic and nationalistic. But I think that some people in Lithuania, and I suspect that I tend to agree with them, think that there is at least a potential for conflict between nationalism and democracy.
What is that conflict between nationalism and democracy?
Well, I think that when it comes down to it, the nationalists would be prepared to sacrifice democratic values, such as the right of a newspaper to criticize the nationalist leaders, if they felt that those democratic practices or democratic values threatened the national goals or the overriding national priority on securing independence. I think that the history of nationalist movements in Europe suggests that once those kinds of priorities are set and nationalism becomes the first priority as opposed to democracy, that the potential for dictatorship exists. And in fact, all three Baltic republics slid from democratic governments into authoritarian kinds of governments during the 1930s.
Do you think that nationalism sometimes goes along with a certain cultural chauvinism that can be anti-democratic, especially for the minorities living in the culture?
It certainly can, and I think that there are no end of examples where that can occur in the Soviet Union. It's a real hodgepodge of national groups which all have the opportunity now to assert their national identity and claim their national rights, and it quickly devolves into a kind of law of the jungle situation where every group is out to try to assert itself, to control its territory, and to, in some cases, dominate smaller groups within its sphere of influence.
Well, can you explain why is it that we are simultaneously seeing within the Soviet Union a move toward democracy and ethnic fighting?
Well, I think the principal reason is that under the old system in the Soviet Union, all kinds of political expression were prohibited. That included aspirations for human rights and democracy, and it also included things like anti-Semitism and national chauvinism. They were all repressed. Once you let the lid off, you can't decide that the kinds of expression you'll permit are the Andrei Sakharov kinds of expression and not the Pamyat kinds of expression. And both currents exist in Soviet thought.
Let's talk a little bit about Romania. You just a couple of weeks ago had an article about Romania in the New Yorker magazine. Why wasn't there a bigger dissident movement in Romania?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's one that I tried to answer when I was there last summer and again in January. And I think that there are a couple of reasons. One is rooted in Romanian history. For centuries, they were under the domination of the Ottoman Empire, and then under the domination of a rather corrupt and tyrannical aristocracy. And the people just developed the habit of submitting and not saying what they felt. Under Ceausescu, that was certainly the wisest way to live. I can tell you one story. When I went to Romania in August, I tried to be as inconspicuous as I could. I went on a tourist visa because it was difficult or impossible to get a journalist visa. And I didn't try to interview any dissidents until the very end of my stay there, when I went to see a man named Gabriel Andreescu, whose name had been given to me by a Romanian emigre organization, which assured me that while he might get in trouble for meeting with a foreign journalist, he probably would be better off for having attention paid to him. It would be some kind of protection for him if the authorities there knew that he had foreign contacts. So I went to his apartment, and I asked him that question, and he said there were several things. One, as I mentioned, was the tradition of submission, the culture of Romania. For instance, in Poland and in Hungary, the Catholic Church is the predominant religion. And the Catholic Church is an international organization that is not beholden to any particular government. In Romania, they have an Orthodox Church, which traditionally has submitted to the government of the country in which it exists, so that there's a Russian Orthodox, a Romanian Orthodox, a Greek Orthodox Church. And societies which have predominantly an Orthodox religion are not as prone, I don't think, to dissent as are those which have a Catholic or a Protestant tradition. And then he said there was the question of a very efficient, very Stalinist, and very thorough security apparatus. And I think it's the case that those countries in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union itself, which have had dissident movements, have not had them until such time as the Stalinist system relaxed somewhat and allowed people to begin to meet and express themselves. That's what gives rise to dissidence. And I found out exactly what he meant as soon as I left his apartment. Three or four security agents surrounded me, hustled me into a car, took me to a police station, searched me, took all my notes and my tape recording, and had me at the airport and on a plane out of the country within hours. They had kept his apartment under surveillance, and as soon as somebody came to see him, they got into action. So they kept that tight lid on the country. Andreescu, as it turned out, was also taken in for interrogation after he saw me and wound up being exiled to a small town about 100 miles from Bucharest. With that kind of security apparatus, you're not going to have much of a dissident movement. And that's, I think, the principal reason why Romania didn't.
You say that Romania proved that the Communist Party isn't invincible, and it was no coincidence that Gorbachev started the multi-party system in the Soviet Union after the fall of Ceausescu.
Mm-hmm.
Would you elaborate on that?
Well, I think that up until Romania, there was a sense that if the Communist Party in any communist society chose to shed blood in order to maintain its power, it could do so and maintain its power. I think that Romania showed that that's not the case. And I don't think that that example was lost on either the Soviet Army or on the Soviet Communist Party. I think it is an open question anymore as to whether if, for example, the Communist Party decided to either remove Gorbachev and impose a more conservative regime or to keep Gorbachev but get rid of perestroika and glasnost, whether A, the people would accept that the way they used to accept that sort of thing when, say, Brezhnev did it to Khrushchev, or whether the people would not go out onto the streets. And if the people go out onto the streets, I think it's an open question as to whether the Army could be relied upon to maintain order and to shoot them if necessary to get them back into their houses and their factories.
Well, you actually raised a very interesting question in one of your articles. You said it's unclear now whether the Russians still possess the capacity for cruelty required for any political power, for any, like, large political power. What's changed? I mean, why? And who do you think needs to have that capacity for cruelty? Is it just the people at the top, or do the people in general have to condone that on some level for it to exist?
I think that both have to exist. I think that the people in general have to be convinced that there is some good reason for them to go out and shoot people if necessary to impose their system. I think that the rank-and-file soldiers in Czechoslovakia in 1968, for example, really thought that they were going into Czechoslovakia at the request of the socialist elements there to protect them from subversion or invasion by the capitalists. And therefore, they were prepared to shed blood if they had to in order to suppress the Czechoslovakian Prague Spring. The leadership has to believe that that will work, that their problems will be solved by the use of force. And I don't think that in either case the Russians are that confident anymore. I know that there appear to be two or three competing points of view within the Soviet elite. One point of view probably wishes at least that it could go back to the old style of doing things and suppressing dissidents by force. But I think that a much broader group of people within the Soviet elite now looks at other models of power and success. It used to be that an empire defined power and success for a country. But I think that the Soviets are well aware that the most successful countries in the world over the last 20 or 30 years have been Germany and Japan, which have not aggrandized themselves by conquering other countries or by adding to their territory, but have done it by achieving a high economic development level and a highly educated population with some cohesion to it.
Conquering markets instead of populations.
Conquering markets instead of population. And I know that that model appeals to a lot of Russians, and they realize that the old imperial model is counterproductive. And so I think that within the Soviet leadership, there are both elements. And I think that unless you're convinced that your model is correct and in the end best for everybody concerned, you're not going to be able to shed blood. The Russians are not naturally barbarians. They're decent people. And they were able to shed blood when they thought that in the end, communism would be best for the whole world. They don't think that anymore, and I don't think that they, at least, I don't think that all of them, or even a majority of them anymore, would be prepared to shed blood to impose their system. And once they're not prepared to shed blood, I don't think they can hold the system together.
Well, keeping the Soviet Empire together has become a very expensive proposition for the Soviet Union. Do you think that there are many political leaders and Soviet citizens who would just as soon see the Soviet Empire shrink a little bit for economic reasons?
Well, it's an interesting question. I spoke to a number of economists on my last trip to Moscow, and what appears to be the case is that under Brezhnev, before Glasnost, those economists who were able to figure out how much the empire was costing Moscow in terms of subsidized prices for oil and so forth, those people who had a sophisticated enough grasp of economics to know that were suppressed to some degree. Not that they were put in jail, but their articles were not published, their opinions were not brought up to the level of the political leadership. Only after Glasnost were they able to put their point of view forth and to bring it to the attention of the leadership. So I think that within that sophisticated and progressive segment of the Soviet leadership, at least, they now understand how much the empire cost them, and that's one of the critical reasons why they were unprepared to try to stop the spinning away of the Eastern European satellites when it began to occur in 1988 and 89.
Journalist Robert Cullen is my guest. You were based in Moscow for some time as the Moscow correspondent for Newsweek. Are you sorry to be back in the States now? Now that there's, you know, such earth-shattering events happening there all the time.
In some respects, yes, but in some respects, I think that it was a lot more pleasant to be a correspondent in Moscow in the time that I was there from 82 to 85 than it is now.
Pleasant in what sense? That there was more food or what?
No, not that. There was less news. And what you could get from the newspapers and from those limited contacts that were allowed with Soviet sources was manageable. Now there's so much going on and so much to write about that the correspondents in Moscow are working themselves to death. So I find that I have probably the best of both worlds. I can get over there fairly often in order to write about particular subjects that interest me. But I don't have to burn myself out the way I think that the steady correspondents over there have to do. It's really a rat race for them now. There's just so much there to do, so much that's available to write about that they're going all the time. The poker game that used to be a staple of life for the correspondents in Moscow every Thursday night doesn't exist anymore, as far as I know.
Everyone's too busy?
That's right.
Well, Robert Cullen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Cullen's articles on Eastern Europe have appeared in The Atlantic and The New Yorker magazine. He has an article on Lithuania coming out in the July issue of The Atlantic. He also has two forthcoming books. One's a novel called Soviet Sources, based on his experiences as the Moscow correspondent for Newsweek. The other is a nonfiction book of reporting on changes in the Soviet Union, and that will be called On the Edge of the Empire. The novel's coming out next month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.